Welcome to the Autism Blueprint Podcast. I'm your host, Janine Hershkovitz, and it's my goal to help you create a more peaceful home while living with autistic and neurodivergent loved ones. Each episode, we focus on a different room in the house and help you create a peace plan for your home. So let's get started. Hey friends, welcome to the podcast. I'm glad that you're here with me. We are on Miss Cat's couch again today, talking about preparing for back to school. So I know that many of you are preparing. Some of you have already sent your kiddos back to school. Either way, this is a great listen. You're going to find out stuff that you may not have known, because I learned a few things in this one from Miss Cat, who is my assistant clinical director in my private practice at Puzzle Piece Counseling. And she is a wealth of knowledge, licensed marriage and family therapist. I think you're really going to enjoy it. So definitely stick around for her amazing advice. Also wanted to let you know, if you're listening to this on audio, we now have a YouTube channel. So you can see the guests that I have on. You can see me. We record everything on video and then convert it to audio. So now, finally, much awaited, we have our YouTube channel up, and that link is in the show notes. So definitely check that out. And without further ado, we're going to jump into my conversation with Catherine. Well, Catherine Scott is back on the podcast. Welcome back, Kat.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to dive into some back to school advice and discussion. And I wanted to start out today with, what are you seeing at this time of year? You know, what do you usually see as far as struggles and things like that in your office?
Utter chaos. No, just kidding.
Surprised.
I feel like going back to school just doesn't have the novelty and the excitement that it used to. Especially just, I feel like post-pandemic, it's just gotten like harder and harder to take a deep breath and jump back into it for everybody. But you know, what am I seeing right now? Let's see, a crippling pressure to succeed. Success is becoming more and more just out of reach. You know, like right now I see 7th and 8th graders getting college advisors and college counselors already. So that's pressure. Yeah, overexhausted school admin and just special ed departments. I mean, just poor schools, especially in Florida. I'm sure it's not that much better anywhere else. They're just busting at the seams. And so this makes upholding any sort of 504 IEPs correctly very difficult, from what I'm finding. And then just the horrific bullying and the fatigue.
Tell me about the bullying that you tend to see.
I feel like bullying has gotten sharper. You know, I think growing up, we saw like bullying be, you know, the whispers behind backs and the swirlies in the toilet bowl and just kind of all that way. But now I think the common catchphrase I hear is, you should just go kill yourself, and here are the ways you should.
Wow.
And just, yeah, it's pretty, cutthroat out there. And it's relentless too. You know, it's once somebody has been identified as like the focal point, it's really hard to get out from under that thumb. And just social media and technology just make it even thicker.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, how do you, because I remember, you know, back when my kids were in school, I mean, the internet was new, but it wasn't nearly what it is now, where it was being used all the time, you know, on a daily basis. What do you see that as a bigger issue?
Just the internet as a whole. Everybody knows that Miss Cat really doesn't like technology. And so, I mean, just between the addictive nature of video games, how video game developers are actually working with addiction specialists to make them more addictive. Yeah, that's a fun fact there. And then just how readily available it is, even just for our youngsters to hop into something that they developmentally weren't ready to learn about, but the knowledge is just there.
Yeah.
it's, and especially whenever we kind of bring it into the neurodiversity lens, you know, filters are difficulty anyways. And so whenever we jump into a world with absolutely no filters, it's just a very difficult rabbit hole.
What do you usually recommend to parents? And I know we're going to dive more into what you feel like parents need to know, but specifically about the online universe and helping their kids navigate that. What do you usually recommend for them?
It's difficult. It's so much easier to take a preventative standpoint than jumping in when there's crisis, especially with technology. And so what do I recommend? And like, what's realistic is difficult to navigate.
Yeah.
But you know, it's starting early with creating a culture around screens and technology that the things on your screens aren't meant to be hidden, aren't meant to be shied away from. And so, you know, I really recommend parents join their children in whatever they're watching on the screen before they ask them to put it away. You know, do some co-regulation, do some joining, learn about their world a little bit before you're like, hey, let's wrap it up. You know, I see so many parents get lost in the weeds of behavior of, okay, I hate screens, like be done with it or else. But I really want parents just to create a culture of like, the screen isn't the bad guy here. Yeah. It's what's on the screen. And so if we create kind of a culture around your screen isn't something to be hidden, I think that helps curb a lot of the iffy stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I think too, that I'm seeing younger and younger children having access to things that certainly my children didn't have access to. And I know that pediatricians are making recommendations, child development specialists are making recommendations. Do you have a specific recommendation for parents as far as what age do you think it's okay to start with a phone, things like that? Phones in schools have an interesting relationship.
Yeah. And here's the like famous therapist phrase of it depends. Screens are such a helpful tool when it comes to people with autism, you know, that screens can be used for good. And so I very much want to leave space for that. You know, screens sometimes are the means of communication for a lot of our kiddos, the means of self-expression, the means for community. And so I want, again, to hold space for that. And I don't want to villainize screens. However, your kiddos' behavior and emotional regulation are going to tell you when they've gone too far. So for example, let's say I have littles getting into things like Minecraft and Roblox and stuff of that nature, 5, 6, 7 years old at this age. And if they are able to hop off the screens without a big emotional, you know, meltdown or overreaction, if they're able to have other interests, other points of conversation, other ways of relating, that means that they're able to regulate, integrate, and regulate all their sensory systems off and on it. The issue with screens is that the pixels typically move at a quicker rate than our eyes used to in reality. Okay. And so that creates a serotonin and dopamine raise. It's like smoking a cigarette, what I tell parents. And so it makes our system feel good. And whenever we have to get off the screen, our eyes have to readjust to reality, which moves slower. And so again, if your child's having an okay emotional reaction to this, that means that their sensory system is able to stay regulated, or they're able to manage that wave. If there's big blow-ups, if they struggle to talk about anything else, relate to anything else, if they're writing about Minecraft and all of their school assignments, that's telling me that they're not regulating or integrating properly. And so at that point, I always, you know, tell parents, like, you know, let's take a break. Let's take a pause. I never like to say, let's take it away. But it's really just, you know, I always say, let's air out the sheets. Let's take a breather. Let's recenter. And let's kind of learn some more coping tools and see how that sensory integration develops. And then we can try again. I don't know if that answers your question. But.
Oh, it does. And, you know, I think the sensory integration. And for those that don't know what that is, can you explain for a minute what sensory integration is?
When you favorite topic. It's so funny. I feel like whenever we talk, I always have to throw in the sprinkle here and there. But sensory integration. So we actually have 8 sensory systems. School lied to us. It's not 5. It's 8. And I'm pretty sure they didn't tell us about the last 3 because they're just long and hard to say. But there are our proprioceptive systems, which helps us know how hard or how soft to touch something. And then there is our vestibular system, which is actually located in our inner ear, but that helps us know where we are in space so we don't feel like an astronaut all the time. And then we have our interoceptive system, which helps us know when we're hungry, when we're out of breath, when our tummy hurts. And those systems are actually directly related or tied to our emotional regulation. So if we are in fight or flight mode, our parasympathetic system makes all those systems be hyper aroused. And all of a sudden we're melting down. We're very sensitive. We can react on a, you know, drop of a hat. And that system raises if we're having trouble going from screens to no screens, because our parasympathetic system's like, ah, the good feelings are not coming at a rate that we enjoyed. Help. And so that's what I mean. Like, your emotions are signaling that something within your body is unbalanced and you're trying to get back to equilibrium.
And this is true for all humans, right? Not just neurodivergent ones. Yeah.
The thing with neurodivergent humans is that there's a scale. So there is hyper arousal, where all those sensory systems are like live wire, very like in fight or flight mode. And then we have hypo arousal, where it's actually shut down, numbing out, and almost like that reboot. Like, I think we've seen a lot of, like, even in just neurotypical people, but also just kind of our neurospicy population as well, how they sometimes just shut down. And then there's that zone of tolerance in the middle. Everybody has a different zone of tolerance, but for our neurodivergent population, it's typically way smaller. So that's why routines, that's why predictability, that's why expectations are really important, because if those aren't met, they're in this space that's uncomfortable.
Right, right. And I'm glad that you said that, because I feel like both with parents and teachers, when a child gets dysregulated, mm-hmm. and that's what's happening, it often looks like bad behavior.
I always educate everybody. Like, I have them write it down. Don't jump in the toilet bowl with them.
Tell me what you mean by that.
So when a child is exhibiting a behavior you don't enjoy, or a loud one, an uncomfortable one, it's hard to not jump in the chaos with them. Because imagine when your child's feeling something big, it's showcasing that they're having a really difficult time with something. And so they're swirling in this toilet bowl of catastrophizing, of this is over, my life sucks, you're not hearing me, you hate me, like all those really strong words that are meant to evoke, but they don't have the proper language to advocate for their feeling. So they're using all these strong words. And that's when parents, teachers jump in and be like, don't talk to me that way, you're in trouble, yada, yada. Like, they get lost in the weeds of the behavior.
Yeah.
And yeah. So I always tell people, sit on the edge of the toilet bowl and be like, wow, that looks uncomfortable. I can't hear you, and I can't meet your need when that expression is being made. And so almost bringing to light of, like, if you don't know what to do in those moments, track them. Oh my gosh, I hear your voice is really loud. I see your body is moving really big. Your eyebrows are really scrunched. Something's really uncomfortable for you.
I love that you said that, because the other day, my kids they're grown kids, by the way. Those that haven't listened to the podcast before, I have 2 adult neurodivergent kids living with us. And my son, who's limited in his verbal ability, went over to his sister and like tapped mm-hmm. her. And like when you were talking about, is it proprioception, where you don't know how hard or soft you're doing something? Mm-hmm. So that's an issue that he has. And if we didn't know that, we would think he was trying to hurt her. Now, has he tried to hurt her in the past? Yes, but that's for another podcast. But in this case, he was just trying to like interact with her or touch her on the shoulder, and he did it really roughly and she jumped. And so, you know, to speaking to that with what you just said, I just brought it to his attention and I just said, hey, Ben, when you touched your sister, you did it really rough. So here, let's try it again so that she doesn't think that you're trying to hurt her. You know, and that could have gone either way. And I know there are times in the past where I just, you know, exploded as a parent and said, don't do that. You don't hit your sister, and, you know, got punitive about it or had a consequence where if we do track them, like you said, and say, oh, I see this is happening. It's a better outcome.
And it doesn't evoke shame. I think that's a really big thing too. Like the way that you responded, it was from such an observer standpoint, and therefore there wasn't shame invited to the narrative. And so in that point, I think Ben was probably much more willing to engage in the feedback because he was like, oh, okay. It was neutral.
100%. And it was interesting because it was a little different than I would, you know, usually. Sometimes I just walk away and let them fight it out, but
sure. Appropriate.
So getting back to kind of school beginning and things like that, I hear a lot of parents in my office complaining about the getting out the door on time. Seems to be, and I remember trying to get my kids out the door on time. Mm-hmm. This seems to be one of the biggest issues. Mm-hmm. How do you approach that with parents?
Oh, it's my favorite one. I mean, personally, it's hard for me to get out the door in the morning. I'm not sure this is just, localized to children. I think this can be taken in far into adulthood. However, I was working with a few parents this past couple of weeks about this thing, and it's almost like I love to presume competence. I love to be able to sit down with kiddos and invite them into the problem solving versus taking it over from them. So with a lot of our population, executive functioning is not a strong suit. Being able to utilize prefrontal cortex in a way that isn't interrupted by big emotions is also difficult. And so those things are needed when you're trying to get out the door. You're having to plan, you're having to organize, you're having to prep, and you're having to execute. There's a lot of really difficult steps that happen right when somebody wakes up. And so I like to hold space for that too. Of it's difficult to jump into a world that's not predisposed for our neurodivergent folks. Like our world wants everybody to fit into a box and to never make any noise and to just go with it. And it's a really hard box to have to hop into right when you wake up. Mm-hmm. It's an oppressive one. It's a difficult one. It's a cringy one. It's a sensory overloaded one. And so there's not a lot of motivation to want to do it. Yeah. Rightfully so. Very valid in that. And so I like to almost sit down with these kiddos and say, hey, like our system needs an update. You know, we had the summer system and now it's almost time to shut down our computer and do an update like mine had to do for 37 minutes before this. But but almost like write it down. Like as you're troubleshooting this, like use all the lingo that they're familiar with. Like if your kiddo is a big techie one, troubleshoot it. Write down the updates that need to happen. You know your child's world best. Use the language that they most resonate with. And then write it down. Use visual aid. A lot of the time, if we're nagging or lecturing or encouraging our children, it's very auditory. That's not a strong suit for most of our kids. Most of our kids are either kinesthetic.
That's a fantastic point that I hadn't even thought of. Yeah. Most parenting takes place through us speaking and them hearing us.
Mm-hmm. And you know how Charlie Brown had all the adults sound like, wah, wah, wah? That there's a good point there.
Yeah.
A lot of the time, that's what parents sound like to kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not on purpose. They just don't have that strength built yet. A lot of people's auditory isn't a strength at the beginning. So it's kind of a skill you have to develop. And so a lot of kiddos learn through kinesthetic, so hands-on, or visual. which is looking. And so getting them involved as much as possible, using their hands, that's going to be helpful. So, you know, let's troubleshoot it. Let's write down the steps of the morning. Have them write it down while you're talking. So they're making those connections. And then be like, cool, let's talk about a visual aid. Let's go to Michael's. Let's get all these creative stuff. You know, let's make it together.
Yes.
Because during that time of discussion, you're also connecting. Mm-hmm. And you're creating safety around the conversation. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of the time kids can expect to get in trouble getting out the door. Parents are gruffy in the morning. They haven't finished their coffee. They have a bajillion things on their minds. They have to go to work. And connection is lost. Which, I mean, it's very easy to do. I'm really learning this now firsthand with a 15-month-old. Getting her out the door is like herding a rabid cat.
Yes.
So, but you never want to lose sight of connection, because once you do that, then it just becomes an argument about something that has nothing to do with the goal.
Talk a little more about connection, because that's a big Miss Cat word as well that I love. Mm-hmm. Talk about, you know, how, why that's important.
Connection is so lost in the world of productivity nowadays. I mean, there's so much pressure to be a successful human. Expectations are just getting higher and higher and more inaccessible, and people panic. And whenever we're panicking or lost in the weeds of our own emotions, we forget that our littles have never done this before. You know, this is the first time they're navigating life too. And so it's really just being able to reframe the prioritization of connection and genuine connection, because our kids know when we're faking it.
Oh yeah.
Neurodivergent or not, they're little radars for this stuff. And so that's a universal thing, is that our kids watch us even when we don't think they're watching us.
Yes.
We are a constant model. We're constantly on stage. And so connecting it during the summer is so much more accessible because there's more time. Mm-hmm. There's less pressure. But now that school starts, there's pressure to get out the door, go to school, make good grades, come home, do the sports and the entertainment, resume building stuff, make the dinners that's healthy and dye-free and nut-free and joy-free and all that fun. Go to bed on time. There's no joy in the pressures that we all have to function by. And so it's paramount to parent through connection, which is joining them with whatever ridiculousness they're watching in that moment. Cracking a joke, commenting on the way that they're dressing today, that you're vibing with it. Be silly. These are moments that can be so fleeting. Mm-hmm. But the more authentic that you are, the more connected you are, and the more that your kid's going to buy in.
And you know, I think that has so much to do with where the parent is in their own kind of mental health journey.
Yes.
I mean, I can definitely say that I'm a better parent and have been a better parent when I take care of my needs. Mm-hmm. Make sure my needs are taken care of first. I remember when the kids were school age, I would get up about 2 hours before they would, just so that I could have coffee by myself.
Yeah.
Not every day. I mean, maybe 3 days out of the week. Exactly. You know, I could go for a walk if I needed to. I could, you know, depending on if I slept the night before, you know, I knew that I was a better parent and was better able to hold my stuff together when I took care of my needs first. And so I think for parents, kind of figure out what is that thing, just one thing that you need to make sure that you have in place before the kids get up so that they're not three steps ahead of you.
Sure.
You know,
and even when,
sorry
to interrupt you, but even when they outrun you at 7:30 in the morning because they get energy off of air, know that your effort and your intention is far more important than the product.
And
you don't have to execute your parenting perfectly. Your kids won't know if you're doing it right or not. Yeah. But if they see that you're showing up and that you're authentic and you're being real and intentional and letting them know what you feel so they don't have to make it up by themselves. If you're able to just say, "Oof, you know, I've got a hard day ahead of me and this is how I'm preparing." Like, if you're intentional in inviting them into your world, that's what matters. Mm-hmm. Because you're giving them permission to be human too.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think for so long, at least the way that I was raised, the parents had their thing going on, mm-hmm. right? And they had like all of the knowledge. There was a top-down approach to parenting. Mm-hmm. And then they imparted that wisdom to you and you listened.
Yes.
Or you
didn't. Sit down on my knee. Let me tell you about my ways. Right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think that what you're saying is more of a collaborative.
It's in the moment. Yeah. It's showcasing that being a human and being imperfect is permissible.
Yeah.
It's okay. You're allowed to have hard days. You're allowed to not be superhuman all the time.
Right.
You're allowed to laugh at the ridiculousness. You're allowed to not know what to say. You're allowed to have your own experience about something they told you, and it might not be the most helpful to them in that moment. Mm-hmm. You're allowed.
Yeah.
But as long as you're intentional about the delivery, mm-hmm. that's what matters. So that your kid doesn't, kiddo, sorry, I'm using kid today. I hate that word. It reminds me of a goat. Sorry, very big segue. But as long as your kiddo doesn't presume the responsibility of what's going on in your world, you win.
What would that look like when they do that?
Internalizing. They're trying to read the room. They're trying to understand why you're feeling something that you're feeling. They're trying to understand why you're mad, why that's a big deal, why this, why that. And it's so much more helpful if parents just help them fill in the blanks or even just say, "Hey, I know this is kind of confusing. Do you have any questions?"
Yes. Especially, and this happens often in homes. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I know it happens in mine, where a parent is in a bad mood or something's not quite right. And every time the child's going to think it's them. Mm-hmm. Because they're egocentric. That's, right. You know, any child under the age of, what would 7. You say? 7? Mm-hmm. Maybe even under 10 in some cases. Yeah. They're going to think
7 is when they think the whole world revolves around them. And then from like 7 until into your 20s, that's expanding. So it's under construction.
Yeah. Yeah. And then in kids with a developmental disability, even a little bit longer.
Yeah. Or permanently.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think that's why I always make sure, and I tell parents this as well, if you're having a really bad day, don't feel like you have to suck it up and be different. Mm-mm. Instead, tell your child, you know, even if you have a child that's limited in their verbal ability, you know, tell them, you know, "Mommy's got a headache today. Mm-hmm. I'm not feeling great. You know, it's not you. You didn't do anything to cause this."
Right.
You know, and then you're teaching them this really great lesson of everybody has their own feelings and they're entitled to their own feelings. And you're not responsible for that.
And within autism, feelings can be such a gray area. They're so undefined and they're so abstract. So automatically they're scary.
Yeah.
And so if as a parent, you're able to put language to the scary feeling, all of a sudden you're letting them look at the boogeyman under the bed and you're showing them, you can do this too.
Yes. Yes. And I know that people have child development specialists, and I think even Mr. Rogers has a quote about this, although I'm not sure what the quote is. I'm going to mess it up. That if a child can put words, can label that feeling, then we can work with it.
Right.
But if they don't know what they're feeling, which a lot of children don't, and then a lot of people on the spectrum have alexithymia, word of the week, alexithymia. Which we were talking about yesterday, where you're not sure what you're feeling. You know, you're feeling something. And it can be scary because, you know, excitement and anxiety can have a lot of the same symptoms in your body.
They live in the same part of the brain.
Do they?
Yes. The same portion of your brain lights up when you're anxious and when you're excited. How just evolutionary upsetting is that? Like, I'm still mad about it.
Yeah. I got questions.
Right.
So the difference is the meaning that you assign to it?
The difference is the nuances that that brings up for you. So we're like, so for excitement, it's usually paired with a positive thing, but your body still increases its heart rate. You still kind of get sweaty when you're excited. You still kind of can't talk. You still kind of jitter.
Yeah.
But it's in such a pro-social setting, there's no pressure to function during it. Everybody's like, oh, you're excited. Let me ride that wave with you. But when you're anxious, you have to do it alone. It's about something uncomfortable and you're isolated. And nobody wants to join you in that, so you have to keep it in. Isn't that fascinating?
How do we join our kids in the difficult feelings? The anxiety, the anger, the sadness. You know, some parents get really upset when their kids cry.
Sure, it can be triggering for whatever the parent's carrying as well. And so really, I just tell people, go back to tracking. If you need a moment to gather yourself, let yourself be an observer and say, wow, bud, I see your face is red. I hear your voice is loud. I'm seeing you do this. Like, model for your kids, because that is showing them that you're attending, that you're curious.
Yeah.
That they don't have to convince you that they're angry. A lot of the time, kids' anger gets so big because they're trying to convince you that the feeling is real and valid.
Yeah.
And so if in that moment you give yourself that minute to gather yourself and prepare for whatever is about to happen, track. It doesn't matter how old anybody is. You can go up to your partner and be like, woof, you got that line right there. And it's really deep. Like, I think you've been working on something and worrying all day. Like, I wonder what's going on for you.
Yes. I love that. That's another word of the week, tracking, which you and I use all the time as therapists, but sure. To just be able to observe out loud.
Yeah.
Is really priceless. What do parents need? Like, what advice do you give them going into a school year if their child is, I mean, school refusal is usually the term, and I don't like that term, but there are lots of kids out there that just are scared to death of school.
Yeah. Oof, that's such a convoluted one, because again, it depends. It depends how well the school is able to make accommodations. It depends the history behind why school refusal is a thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's school can be such a concrete thing within our neurodivergent population. Like, once we've experienced the thing that has really become so of light is that people on the autism spectrum cannot forward think.
Okay.
So I think that's one of the most distinctive things that makes such a big difference, is they can't forward think, they can't future think, they can't be like, if this is different and this is different, then this will probably be different. They live in the past, they live in history, and they live in the present.
Mm-hmm.
So it's so difficult, if something traumatic has already happened at a particular school, to convince somebody with autism that it can be different, because there's too much history to back it up. And so sometimes exploring different environments of school is necessary in order to get over that hump and create new history. Again, we want to create historical evidence that school is safe, emotionally, sensory-wise, the whole gamut. And then I always like to start small too. You know, hey, like, if you're able to get there and just put your feet on the ground for 20 minutes, then you win.
Yeah.
Try to stretch that farther and farther. But school refusal is not a short game. It's a marathon.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is something that I would recommend parents navigate with a therapist that understands it. And particularly if your child is neurodivergent or has a disability, to really work with someone on that, because like you were saying before, kids escalate in their behavior and their emotions sometimes because they feel like they have to convince us.
Yes.
And I think that's often one of the biggest reasons why kids will, you know, pretend to be sick or, you know, things like that. And it really, I think, says more about the parent's reaction than it does about the child's. I mean, and I don't want to pick on parents, but I can tell you as a parent that it has been an overreactor. Once my kids knew that I would believe them when they said, I can't do it today, or I can't go today. You know, I didn't need a fever or, you know, proof that they were actually sick to stay home that day.
And school refusal too. It's such a, God, you need a lot of privilege to be able to navigate it successfully. You need to be able to take off work at a dime's note, like a moment's notice. You need to be able to have backup with childcare. You need to be like, there are so many things that go into navigating this that I want to hold space for too. Like my heart hurts for parents who have to navigate this with a boss that's like, I don't care, get here at 8.
Right. Yeah. And that, I think that that's one of the biggest issues that I hear about from parents of children with autism is that, you know, the school, I've experienced it too. I can't tell you how many phone calls I've gotten in the middle of a work day. You know, we can't handle him. You have to come get him. You know, these are all, in my mind, red flags that the IEP that's in place or the 504 is not covering the needs that are there.
Absolutely.
I've had that with both my children where we've had to revisit it. And, you know, and we were very lucky that we had the resources to be able to take off. You know, I mean, my husband was a teacher and I was running a practice when the kids were in school, and it was usually me that, you know, would rearrange the day. And, but this is why a lot of parents can't work, because they feel like they, and rightly so, feel like they can't commit to it.
Yeah.
So that's a toughie. Anything else? I think the only thing we didn't touch on that I wanted you to talk about is play. How important is play to our children's development and daily?
Don't get me started on play. Play is important no matter how old you are. I think that's one of the cornerstones in, you know, not only my work with families and kiddos, but with couples too, is a lot of the time, productivity doesn't allow play. We get so burdened by the pressures of performing, of excelling, of fitting in, of X, Y, and Z, that we completely like rebuke the need to breathe, to play, to process. Playing is processing. Playing is like letting your mind go to sleep and dream. It's necessary. Like how sleep is necessary for our brains to process all the stuff that was left in the day that we couldn't get to yet. So is play. Play is our child's first language until they're the age of 12. And so that's up until about seventh grade, that children require play. That isn't a screen necessarily. And so, I mean, it's just playing doesn't have to be structured. Playing can be joking around. It can be drawing. It can be gathering rocks and putting them somewhere that you like the rocks better. Don't judge play. I think I say that a couple times a week. Don't judge their play.
Yes. And in particular, it with the autism community, I'll never forget it. And I know I've shared this on the podcast before. The first time that I took Ben when he was 4 years old to a behavior therapist, they told him that, now my child never picked up a toy and played with it, like they would say, appropriately. And he took a frog, a pretend frog, and had it flying. And they told him that was wrong and frogs don't fly, they hop. That was the last time we went because No.
Where do I file a complaint?
I know, right? I said, no. We aren't going to teach him how to play. He plays.
Right.
But he's doing it in a way that may not be appropriate to some people. And that's just too bad. He's going to have to play inappropriately. I mean, this was back in the early 2000s. Yeah, it was
absolutely it was not
going to fly with me. So, you know, but I also had to kind of learn about what you were talking about the unstructured play, right? Because when you have a child that doesn't do the things that neurotypical children do, of course you're going to go to the place of, well, let's teach him how to.
Right.
You know, because we assume he doesn't know how to.
Right.
And sometimes that might be the case, but sometimes it also might be the case that they are playing. They're just not letting you in on their game.
Well, I think too, I think their playing sometimes might be very orderly.
Yeah.
You know, their playing is organizing and putting things in structures or, you know, whatever. They're processing in a way that feels good to their brain. And so, again, we want to play safely. Like, we don't want anybody aggressively playing with anybody. I think that's an okay boundary to set. Mm-hmm. But play, that's why game nights really rarely work or suffice as play, because there's just way too much structure, pressure, and time. It's like, okay, you're going to play 3, 2, 1, go. No, that doesn't usually go over very well. Play is random. You know, play is laughing at something ridiculous, or play is doing a funny airplane at dinner time because they just want to eat their chicken, and then all of a sudden you're just gobbling their chicken up like a crazy turkey, and they're laughing and they're forgetting about the pressure for a moment, but you're playing.
Yeah.
Play is important. You don't have to make every moment teachable.
Ooh, wait, say that again. That's important.
Yeah. You don't have to make every moment teachable. And please hear me, parents of those who have kiddos on the autism spectrum, because that's what the world forces you to believe.
Yes.
No. If anything, the moments that you give up the fight to teach is usually the moment that will stick.
Oh, that's so true. That is absolutely so true. Well, before I let you go, what do you think that parents really need to know? This is kind of the final question I always ask at the end of my podcast.
It is, and I'm never prepared.
So just imagine every special needs parent, particularly the neurodivergent ones, were listening. What do you want them to know about back to school?
About back to school?
Mm-hmm. In particular.
Okay, this is going to be like a little offhand, but screw the haters. You know, forget the people that cast judgment. Forget the IEP person at that meeting who looked at you in a shameful way. Like, let yourself do and follow that intuitive mommy or daddy gut. Mm-hmm. Honor your kid. Don't get lost in the shame.
Yeah.
And the judgment and the pressure and the box. Don't get lost in the box.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I absolutely love that. It's perfect. Cool. See, you're good. You're good.
Getting better.
Yeah. My goodness. So Miss Kat, if I know you'll be back on soon, but if people want to get in touch with you in the meantime, what's the best way for them to do that?
I mean, I have an Instagram that I need to get way more involved with, but
I'll post that in the show notes for sure. Your Instagram, people can follow you.
Yeah. And that'd be good. And, yeah. You know, we have Puzzle Piece as well. Hopefully y'all have that information.
I'll link to you.
If not, Janine really needs to start adding that to this podcast.
I assume people know that, you know, I have a private practice, but if you
are not, this is the first time. Go to puzzlepiece.com and look up Kat.
Puzzlepiececounseling.com. Yep. And I'll link to that in the show notes if you want to, you know, bother Miss Kat, email her with your.
I also have a book. But I'm terrible at marketing.
Yes.
And it's on Amazon. Right. So Janine will put that link on there too. It's called The Tale of a Trio. It's pretty cool.
Yes. And I will also link to the episode where you unveiled your new book.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah. So if you want to know more about Miss Kat, just check out our show notes on this episode and I'll have everything listed in there.
Woohoo.
Thanks so much for coming on and we'll chat again soon.
Sounds great. Thank you.
All right.
The information in this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for help from a licensed mental health professional.